Okay, first, can you all hear me? There's some chairs up here at the front. I feel separated by a great chasm by from some of you people at the far back. Can you hear me? Okay, all right. So at the top of my notes, it says, "Cateris paribus boilerplate," to begin with. The first thing I want to say is that this isn't what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about critical papers, the critical work that you do through the program here, but this isn't program policy. This isn't anything that the program itself demands, nor is it the sort of thing that is expected of you by other teachers. We all have our way of teaching, right? And neither one is better or worse than the other. I'm just, for the sake of argument, because I spend a lot of time with my own particular students teaching critical writing and reading, I just decided that I'd sort of share that. God, I hate that word, share. But I just used it. I'm going to share the teaching that I do with you guys here. One of the things that I come up against with students is a certain resistance to doing critical writing, and they make quite a distinction between critical writing and their creative work, and I think at some level that's valuable, and you should of course put a priority on your creative work, but they tend to make too much of a distinction there. I've never met an uncreative piece of writing. You know, the critical writing, in my mind, is just as creative as anything else. And of course, as you know, I write creatively literary and critical essays and publish them in books. So, you know, that means, to my mind, that the critical writing is very important and it's worth practicing, and worth practicing well, just as writing, okay? And as a matter of fact, some of you will, or have, maybe even already have, I don't know who's here, will be able to publish your critical thesis or your lecture. You know, there are markets for this. Not many, but the AWP Chronicle, we have a lot of graduates published there. And so this is not, in any sense, a waste of your time to sit there and spend some time on these critical papers. I've grown up with the idea that people aren't practitioners of a single genre, that I'm not just a novelist or I'm not just a short story writer. I view myself as a man of letters, and you should view yourselves as a man or a woman of letters, or whatever combination of those two you want to be. That means that you can turn your hand to anything. I mean, once you understand how form and structure work, then you know that any new task in terms of writing is just a matter of learning a new form and figuring out how to do it and doing it. So you should be able to write book reviews, you should be able to write critical essays, analytical essays, you should be able to write magazine articles, you should be able to do journalism, you should be able to write novels, you should be able to write poems. And I also don't mean to make a distinction between fiction and poetry and creative nonfiction as well. I mean, it's all the same thing. And anyway, so I find that people who resist these critical papers are actually getting in their own way in lots and lots of ways. The purpose of the critical papers, it seems to me, is on one level to learn a technique, to learn a structure for yourself from your reading that you can apply to your own work. Okay, it's not a place for you to interpret somebody. It's not a place for you to talk about your process. I mean, I've seen all the dodges, by the way. And I know when people don't want to write a critical paper, they come up and say, well, you know, I'm going to lecture on process, and I'm on my process. And I'm sort of sitting there, well, you know, if you were Alice Munro and wanted to talk about your process, maybe that would be valuable. Meantime, what's going to be valuable to you? Talking about your own navel, or talking about an Alice Munro short story, or Scott Russell Saunders' essay, and learning a technique that you can apply in your own writing. Okay, so one thing you want to do with this is learn learn something that you can apply. To me, the deeper lesson after that, and this is what I always tell my students, is what I want, is that I want, when they're done with me, to be able to go out and teach themselves from now on, that they don't need me or any other teacher. Okay, that's the crucial thing, right? I went to the Iowa Writers' Workshop, which was more or less a dismal experience. And I sort of accidentally had one good teacher. And I had one 20-minute session with him. Everything since that has been, I'm being facetious there, because I actually took a class with him on forms of fiction, and we read a novel a week, all right? And he talked about the structure and the techniques in that novel. I wrote about him a little bit in an essay of mine called The Novel as a Poem, because he walked into class one day, the first day of classes, and there's a long row of blackboards here, and he started at one end, and he wrote right across the blackboard, "Remember to tell them the novel is a poem." Okay, I love that. Anyway, everything I've taught myself and everything I've learned and everything that I teach people here has come out of that class and out of that little 20-minute session I had with him, because he taught me how to teach myself. He didn't teach me much in practice. You know, he taught me three little techniques. Okay? But suddenly I understood, you can actually go and find it. You know, there's a thing. And you can plunk it down in your work and make it flow and work for you, you know. So the essay or the story or the novel or the memoir is a little machine of techniques, right? Okay. So you want to end up being able to teach yourself. There's sort of some theory behind this. After I studied with that guy and was starting to teach myself things, I stumbled upon this great Russian writer, Viktor Shklovsky, Shklovsky. And he was one of the founders of a school of criticism called Russian Formalism. This is in St. Petersburg and Leningrad and around the time of the First World War and the Russian Revolution. And he has a sort of founding essay called Art as Device, which is in his book Theory of Prose, which you can all find now. A lot of this has been translated into English and published actually by my American publisher, Dahlke Archive. Art as Device, what they say is that it's that you take content, you take reality. What literary writing is, or what any art is you take content, which might be reality or a thought, whatever, and you make it strange. You make it surprising by making it not what you expected, not what the reader expected. The way you make it strange is by filtering it through literary devices. It's not... He's commonly misunderstood as saying you present something very odd to the reader, like you make some sort of shocking situation or insane characters or something. Well, that's a kind of low level making things strange. All he really means is you run it through literary devices, and then his critical take or his compositional take then is to go through literature and look for devices. Okay, and that's what a lot of his essays in that book are. He has an essay on composition. His essay on composition goes back and looks at early Russian folktales written as verse, and he starts to find repetitive techniques of delay, he calls them. And he pulls them out of these little Russian rhymes. And, you know, I give that to people, and I say, read that. I had one student say, well, what use is this to me? I'm not Russian folk, writing Russian folk rhymes. And then I made her go and... read a Raymond Carver story with that essay. And she found Raymond Carver using at least a half dozen of those techniques from the Russian folktale over and over and over again. Which isn't to say that he knew Russian folk literature, that's not what I'm saying. But a lot of the structures that we use actually are remnants of the great oral cultures, right? A lot of the structures. I mean, where does short story structure, where does narrative structure come from? Well, it comes from the thousands of years of storytelling that happened before we actually started writing things. And so writing is just, we're in the shadow of that great oral culture, which we actually don't know except as we vaguely remember it. So it helps become conscious of these things anyway. So Viktor Shklovsky has one of the devices that he uses in his own writing is called, so you can up this. He calls his one device that he uses bearing the device, you know, showing the device. So he'll tell you what device he's going to use in his, like in his novels, right? He'll tell you what device he's going to use, then he uses it, right? It's very pretty and kind of slightly comic device. So then the final thing, but the introductory thing that I wanted to say about this is that you should all at this stage be starting to, I mean, advise, why I say it, you should all, right? You know, it sounds like I'm giving an order and you'll be very bad if you don't do this. I don't mean it that way. You can do whatever the hell you want. And with my blessing. Yeah. But I found it very helpful at a certain point, and many of my students have, to start keeping a technical notebook. Okay, this is not like a journal. It's not like a diary, and it's not an idea book either. Okay, it's a technical notebook. You know, you start, if you find a technique, if you find something, you can give it a name. You can give it your own damn name, right? There's not a lot of these things have names, but some of them don't. And besides that, you know, I call things butt constructions and globs, and I made up the names myself because you need to own it, right, to make it work for you. You need to understand it on your own terms. So you find a technique, you give it a definition, and you write out your examples. And make notebooks. I really have kind of stopped doing this, but that's because I got old and tired. But I had four big binders full of technical notes. They're still in my study at home, right? And every once in a while, I still leaf through looking for something. Well, I'm a little bored. I'm going to find one that I'd forgotten and try it again, you know? All right, so start keeping technical notebooks. Things that you can teach yourself how to do and then put them into practice. The crucial thing about good critical writing, and now right there I want to stop and stop saying critical, although maybe I'll keep saying it, but it's a misnomer. It's really not a helpful word here because we have literary criticism and critical writing at the academic level, and that's often very beautiful. I have a lot of respect for academic critics. I've sometimes had brilliant readings of my own work done by academics. I love what they do, but they are actually doing something different from what you're trying to do here. Okay, they're finding a lot of thematic interpretation. They're looking for meaning. They're looking for your relationship to other writers, and so on and so forth. That's very useful in its place, but it's not what you're doing here. I lost my train of thought. What you want to do is learn to read as a writer. So okay. So what I've given you in the handout is what I give to all my students. Four pages, not all, the first two pages is what I give to all my students. If you didn't get it, all these things, these outlines and things like that, I put them up on NumeroSync. Do you all know NumeroSync? There's a writer's resource section page, right? And now I've put in a link to something called Critical Papers. I'm collecting a lot of quotations from my old letters to students and stuff like that there, and these outlines are there. And you can read through that. You're welcome to read through that. And it's a work in progress. I'm going to keep adding stuff, right? Okay, the first thing you have to do is you have to read right. And what I find is so many people just don't even know how to approach a text as a work of art. They approach it as something available to them as an intelligent reader or as an academic critic, something they want to interpret, or they want to discuss the psychology of the characters, and so on and so forth. That's generally not the right way to go. And if you write that for me, it generally means that I'm just crossing out pages of your essay, and people will get their whole essays crossed out with me. You want to start by looking this, so I'll just go through the first page, the reading rubric. And this is just, it's incredibly simplistic, and I think people feel almost insulted sometimes when I say, you know, just stop and count the number of pages of the stupid story, please. That's important, you know? It's got to do with pacing, it's got to do with structure, it's got to do with, you know, the story, the novel, the essay, it's framed by silence. And what is there? What is what is the box? How does the box look? Is it broken up into parts? Are there subheads? Are there chapter numbers? You know, how does that work? Are there blocks of italics? Are there asterisks? What has the author done to shape the text before you even read the text? This is important. I count the number of line breaks in a story. You know, I put the number of chapters that the... I have a running thing at the beginning of each novel that I read, and I do... I say the number of chapters, and then I start doing chapter summaries. This is all on the front page of the novel. It's chapter one. You just keep track of that stuff. How long is it? Okay, how's it broken up? Okay, then you start to read, and what you want to do, again, just very simple. What is the point of view structure? This works in both nonfiction and fiction, right? Okay, and this is before you start writing your critical paper, right? This is foundational. Okay, you have to do this before you can start write an analytic paper. Point of view structure in fiction, you know, it's not enough just to say first, second, or third, right? Okay, you want to go farther than that. In nonfiction, if it's a memoir, it's obviously going to be first person, right? Well, sometimes it's not, but sometimes there's a you in there or something. But you know, then you want to notice that. But even within a first person nonfiction piece of writing, there's always going to be some sort of split between the now and the then, the now writing, the then. You want to become aware of that and actually see how it's working in the text. You want to be able to note, this is the scene of the writing, and this is where I'm in the mind of myself when I was 1.5. In fiction, you want to be able to say third person in this character's mind, or third person multiple, this character, name them. You also want to have a sense of the play, because point of view is not monolithic. It is often very elastic. And you're not reading the writer correctly if you don't become aware of the way the point of view will move up, out, to be somewhat objective, and then move deep in, okay, and back and forth in various ranges of that. You stop and think about that as you're reading through. Get that straight. And then make notes about it. Here's a big thing, and it just keeps coming up over and over again in my demand for in critical essays, is summarize. Do a synopsis of the text, okay? And a synopsis shouldn't be any more than a slightly lengthy paragraph. Even for a novel, okay? This is an incredibly useful practice, and it builds through everything. But, for example, when people write book reviews for Numero 5 now, I make them do it. You know, you have your introduction, and then you tell me the story. Tell what the thing looks like. Make it interesting. You know, tell it the way it give it its best reading at some level. So tell me the story of the story. Also in that synopsis, you're going to include rough number of words and that sense of how it's divided up. You know, what is the physical thing like that? What is the synopsis? When people do the critical thesis for me, again, I ask them to do that for every work that they use, that they draw examples from, okay? One of the effects of this is it situates you, the writer of the analytic paper, in the text itself. And then when you start talking about your examples, and this is really crucial, when you start drawing examples from that text, you can say where they're from. Because where they're from in the text has something to do with how they're used. Okay? It's absolutely crucial when you come to do a lecture here, by the way, to do that synopsis. Because I can come up here and start talking to you about a short story by some obscure writer that you may not even have heard of, and let alone having read the story, and you certainly haven't read the story 5 times the way I have in the last month when I come up and lecture to you, you won't know what I'm talking about. If I start saying, well, at this point, Sylvia says, you have no fucking idea what I'm talking about. And you lose the reader. So and that happens up here a lot. You know, I've gone to student lectures where I can't follow what's going on, and I know that the audience is half listening, but probably lost and not really getting the point. So when somebody works with me, I really ask them to do a really nice synopsis before they start discussing their examples so that the audience can be situated. So again, this has something to do with the effect is good for you, but the effect in an oral presentation is very good for the audience as well. And equally in a published situation, when you're writing a book review or an essay, you're writing for people who may not have read, well, if it's a book review, they haven't read the book, unless it's the author who's reading your review. And then, or if you're writing an essay, the person who's reading it may not have read the book. And if you clarified what the book is, or the story, or the essay, you've helped a lot. So this is a really good practice to do every time you're really going to analyze a piece of writing, summarize it. The next thing is just to keep careful track of words, ideas, images, grammatical structures that repeat. And then I said, but do not draw any conclusions about why they repeat yet. Okay, don't interpret. Don't jump to, you know. I've got this student this semester, Cynthia Sample, who's a post-grad student. And I was talking to her on the phone about this, and she said, oh, she said, quotation, not connotation. And I thought, that's it. Quotation, not connotation. Okay, I don't care about the connotation. Quote the text. So keep track of things that repeat. Why repeat? Because repetition is the heart of art. It's the key to almost all structures. And so the first structures, the first techniques you're going to notice are the ones that involve repetition. So you just start noticing that right away. Track, note, number of the instances of important repeated elements. This, in a novel, that could be plot and subplot. Subplot is an important repeated structure in a novel. This applies equally to CNF and memoir writing, obviously, because recursive and repetitive structures are often used or prioritized over any kind of plot element to organize the essay, right? So you want to be careful of that. Fifth thing to notice is time. This, again, all preliminary reading stuff. Time flow. Over and over in workshop, I will ask, you know, what is the time flow of this story? And people have to spin back and think about it, because they haven't actually thought about it yet, even though they've read this other piece of student writing several times, right? The time flow is, you know, a rough and ready thing, but, you know, there's a chronology to any story. And sometimes, like in a meditative essay or a lyric essay of some sort, there, you know, the time flow may not be, there's not going to be a narrative arc, right? There is in memoir, so this works very well there, but in any case, even in a lyric essay or a meditative essay, there will be, absolutely will be a time structure of some sort that you want to become aware of, a back in and forthing, this and that. Start to be aware of that. But in a story or a novel or a memoir, what is the overall chronology? That's one element of the time flow. And what and how is the chronology deployed in the text? That's the most important aspect of time flow. That is, here's my forward on ongoing action. Where's the backfill? How is it deployed? How much of it is there? And there are multiple techniques for deploying backfill. And if you don't start becoming aware of it in the text right at the beginning, then you're not going to learn the techniques yourselves consciously. Okay? For example, there's a story I teach often, very often. I teach obsessively this story. The Point by Charles D'Ambrosio Jr. It's very interesting because on one level, the backfill structure is very conventional. He tells you the situation. The 14-year-old boy has to take a drunk woman home down the beach from a party. And his father has been to Vietnam and come back and killed himself. We know all that in the first couple of paragraphs. So we sort of know everything that's important. The story goes on. We get to the end of the plot. He gets Mrs. Gurney home. And then he goes home. Then he gets up and he goes out. And he reads his father's last letter, and he remembers his father's suicide. The actual plot of the story ends when he gets Mrs. Gurney home. Everything after that, after he goes out and starts thinking again, is backfill. So this story has a huge chunk of backfill at the end after the plot climax. It's really important to notice this, because it's unconventional. It's a brilliant invention. that he's done. All right? He's already told you the backfill, but then all of a sudden he gives you all the detail. He gives you the story. He hasn't hidden it from you, which is a common student, you know, thing. I won't tell you my father committed suicide until the last line of the story. Then you'll know why I was upset with my girlfriend that day. How many times have I read that story? So start to notice. Okay, you notice the time flow. So, okay. Then, if you're doing fiction, you want to talk about, how am I doing for, I'm faster. Plot structure, you know, I have a whole theory about plot structure, which is in that book, Attack of the Copula Spiders, that plot is a desire and a resistance pattern that repeats through the story or the novel, and it's the same desire and resistance, so you can read that and get that theory there. But what I mean by, for reading, you, again, you want to sort of look at the text and say, who's the main character and what's his or her desire, need, want, and what's the main thing resisting it? Okay? And then block that out. You know, what are the steps along the way towards the end? Just get that in your heads. Write it down. It only takes like two lines to get it really straight. And then I say, then number seven is get the sense of the basic steps of that plot. And then the last one is make comparisons. And this is often, this again is something that people tend not to do. There's a not enough comparison and contrast in your minds at just the basic level of reading. What am I reading? What rough sort of thing is this? Is it a love story? Is it an ironic culture criticism? Is it that? Just give it a name. You don't have to be right, right? You're talking to yourself, but you're trying to make. And what's it sort of like? Where have I read something like this before? You know, it's sort of like that, or it's sort of like that, or it's, you know, structurally related to this. Just start making comparisons and judgments. The second page of that handout is what I call a cheat sheet for structural questions, which really just, usually there's more space for you to fill in. So you can actually make up your own cheat sheet, and then it takes about two pages, really. And you can answer basically all those questions on your cheat sheet. So that makes it even easier for you to read, right? Okay. Then you can start working on your essay. I have it a little outline for the first and second semester critical essays, okay? It's on the that critical papers thing. I didn't really think I quite needed it, but I probably did. All you need there, the critical essays, and again, once again, you know, these are just my critical essays. And you might try them on other people and see if they like them, but not. But they're informal. I want you to just get to the point. So you read a story. Give me a synopsis of the story. Name the technique you're going to talk about. Define it in your own words. And by the way, you can give it your own name. I don't care. Define it in your own words. Give me five examples. With a discussion, a quotation, that's five pages or six pages, right? Again, the synopsis is what is very important. It's just practice. At this level, it's just practice because I've read the story before, obviously. But it's practice. But this narrowing things down to a specific technique, that's the hard thing for almost everybody, all right? And it is daunting, okay? And I have often to make students do this repetitively to really get the hang of it. You know, you have to try it and be corrected and try it and be corrected. And some people, by training or by personal bent, just really have a difficult time not interpreting, okay? So it's an interesting thing. But there are some examples of these things on Numero 5. Not a lot of examples of the short papers, okay? In fact, not many at all. And most of them, the two that I've got listed on the back are from Adam Arvidsson, and he was writing, working on nonfiction, so they're CNF. But I'm not apologizing for that. It's just that I haven't had, in the end, Adam is such a pro that, you know, his little papers always look really good, and all he had to do was fix them up a little bit to get them put them up there. But they're nice examples of just getting to the point, giving the technique and giving examples of the technique. And then that's all you need to do. And that's pretty easy, right? And I mean, it's not long. And you don't have to spend a lot of... It's very concrete, okay? When it comes to doing the longer papers, I give you an outline there for that. And I really, because one of the main problems with the longer papers is focus, right? So I give my students an outline and I talk to them about focus. But a very common problem is, the critical papers sort of expand exponentially through the semester and take over your life. And then you find out you haven't actually spent enough time on your own creative work, which is slightly more important. But so I just try to, with the outline, make this as simple as possible. It's just an expansion of the essay, the first essay. So if you do the early critical essay as well, then the longer critical essay is only about 4 of them added together. And you can make it longer simply by, like, the early critical essays are based like one short story or one novel or one essay or one memoir, okay? This one, you can just make it longer by adding a couple of more works, so you're discussing examples from a couple of more works. So on Numeral Sanct, there's a really nice, simple one that Julie Marden did about thematic passages in Chekhov's short stories, okay? And all she does, she has a 3-paragraph introduction that talks about thematic passages and Chekhov. This is a technique, all right? Thematic passages is a technique. You just sort of say, this what a technique, and this is sort of what it does generally. Then she jumps in and she says she's going to discuss 2 Chekhov stories that... Actually, I think hers was a lecture. So 2 makes a lecture, roughly. She just synopsizes the first Chekhov story. Then what she did was kind of interesting. She quoted the thematic passages to begin with, where they are. She gives you the synopsis, then quotes you the passages. Then she starts discussing the passages, show how they relate back to the beginning of the story and the end of the story, and show how, because in that particular story, they're in the middle of the story, and how they kind of frame everything from the middle. And she does that very nicely. Then she just shifts over, synopsizes the second story, does the same thing with that one. And it's very simple then, okay? It's almost, except for the fact that when people are very good, they vary this a lot and they write very well. The structure is that, basically almost every critical essay or lecture on Numeral Sanct used the outline. And you won't see it unless you look very carefully. Another one is Rebecca Martin, who actually was a CNF writer, but she wanted to learn about... She had a really hard time expressing emotion in her nonfiction, right? How do I get emotion out? Well, I said, well, read some fiction and look at the techniques there. So what she did in her critical essay ended being... Oh, it's a sucker, it was like almost 40 pages. She got very excited. But all she did was that she actually only talked about 3 techniques, okay? Character thought, character interaction, and physical manifestations to express emotion. So 3 techniques, 3 authors is what she used. She used 3 authors, Almond, Baldwin, and somebody else. What that meant, she has her narrative introduction. She does a narrative. I like a narrative introduction where you sort of say, why am I writing this essay? What stupid writing problem have I come up against that, where am I falling down? I'm falling down here, so I'm going to write an essay about the thing that I'm falling down about, and I'm going to look at this writer and this writer to figure out how to do what I can't do. That's the narrative introduction. That works perfectly. She did her introduction. Then she defines the 3. She says, these are the 3 techniques I'm going to talk about. She defines them, and then she goes straight into discussion. And what she did that made her essay long, and very usefully long, too, was talk about each writer. So she took the character thought as a way of expressing emotion and went through each writer. And what was really beautiful, and again, we're asking you to compare and contrast. This is very important. She didn't just say, this guy does it this way, and this one does it this way. She went back and forth. You know, she said, he does it this way, but this and this guy does it slightly differently. You know, if you look at this one and then you look at this one, so you get a real rounded picture of the way the techniques vary from writer to writer. It was very beautiful. Another thing she did, because she was an extremely perceptive reader, once she got the hang of doing this, is she's starting to see other techniques along the way. So although she was focused on these three, she started to see other ways that emotion was being expressed, and she would do little asides on that. So that at the end of her essay, she has a page and a half list of other devices that she'd noticed along the way, right? It's a very nice essay. Am I making sense here?
Yes.
Is it having a sense of making this thing seem a little bit simpler to you, a little less daunting in some ways? It should, in the end, be very concrete. So you don't want a topic that's abstract. I'm very careful. I believe in very careful reading as the first event in an analytic paper. And that means a lot of reading is not going to help you. But a very selective, small amount of reading done intensely is going to help you. This is also a problem I find with students, is a tendency to bring in more and more books and be indecisive about which ones they're going to use. Okay, so they end up doing a lot of reading and not reading very carefully, and then it's very hard to write the essay after that. Okay, so I've done that. As I say, on NumeroSync, there are several. These are really good examples that I've listed here on the back, okay? I want now to give you more of an example of some of these things, okay? Anybody, do you want to? You can ask a little questions, right? A little brief. Yes?
So I'm clear about the beginning paragraph. You give the brief narrative and the summary, and then you go into the examples. So I'm clear about the conclusion.
You don't have to have a conclusion.
Okay.
That's the beauty of my essays. Is I don't believe in topics in essays, okay? You know, like I wrote that whole book on Don Quixote, right? And one critic said it's kind of difficult to figure out what the theme of this book is. And I said, yeah, you're damn right. There wasn't one. So, you know, give me a break. I don't write like that, you know? And the same thing. I mean, I learned to write essays from Viktor Shklovsky, who wanders along and digresses and jumps ahead and then goes back and repeats what he said before. That's, to me, that's the quintessential essay. So, no, you don't have to have a conclusion, right? And for the longer essays, then, you know, basically if you've done this right and you've thought your way through these techniques, then, you know, you really don't need much of a conclusion there. It's not like you have a thesis. You're talking about a concrete machine, right? You know, it's like, this is the machine. This is how it works. This is how I can make it work. You know, you can even do that at the end.
You can put it at the end. This is how I'm going to make it work.
You can do that. You can do that. Yeah, I believe, you know, again, this is, you know, what I say. So I just want to, just so you have a vague idea of this, I'm just going to read this to you, so that's not, but you can go online and look at you can see the examples, and I pull out some of the synopses in that critical papers thing. Critical papers thing, by the way, is 90 pages long so far. You know, it's, someday I'm going to have this immense thing. This is Julie's description of Anton Chekhov's story, Grief, okay? This is a synopsis. Anton Chekhov's story, Grief, is about a talented turner or woodworker and abusive alcoholic named Grigory. He's a poor Russian peasant and has been married for 40 years, coming home drunk and beating his wife every night until the night before the story begins. Yes, there's a flashback. That night, Grigory comes home. That's what she says. She says, yes, there's a flashback. That night, Grigory comes home drunk and is about to beat his wife when she gives him a look that scares him so much that he doesn't beat her. Instead, first thing next morning, he borrows a neighbor's horse and sledge to take her to the rural district hospital to cure her of whatever is causing the funny look. It's not really that funny when you read Chekhov, but you know, you can be amusing. It's fun to write it like this, right? that scared the shit out of him the previous night. And you see, she can be informal. I don't, you know, you can have your own voice in these things. But a terrible blizzard slows him down, no matter how hard he whips the borrowed horse. His wife dies before they reach the hospital. Gregory thinks he should head to the cemetery, but for some reason keeps heading to the hospital. He gets lost. Night comes. He starts to freeze. His hands become so numb he can't control the reins. The horse goes on unguided until it stops in front of a building, which Gregory can just make out in the dark and through the snowstorm. By this time, Gregory's so cold that he can't move his feet, so he decides, as if he has any choice, to fall asleep in the sledge, not even minding that he might die in the process. But he doesn't die. The next day, he wakes up in the hospital. He recognizes the doctor, the one he'd wanted to take his wife to. He wants to get out of bed and fall on his knees to thank the doctor or beg him for help. He's quite confused, but he can't move. He has lost all four of his limbs to exposure. The doctor tells him not to complain. He's had a good, long life, and leaves the room. The end. Grief is short, about 2,000 words, gets it in, and is told by a third-person narrator, limited for the most part to Gregory, who delivers a long, muttered monologue in the first half, which doesn't really end until he falls asleep, but which is interrupted midway through by the narrator. The other character who speaks in the story is the doctor, but just for a few lines. Now, you got a picture of the story, don't you? And you know how long it is. You know, even know what it looks like. You even know what it looks like on the page. You even know that it's third person, but there's a good chunk of first person monologue in it, right? It's a really sweet little summary, okay? And that's the sort of thing you... And then she can go on and discuss the technique of the thematic passages and tell you where it is in the story and how it relates to other parts of the text quite easily. Does that help her? Do you want another one just to hear it?
Yeah.
This is a crucial thing. And over and over and over, when I go through my letters to former students, you know, over and over and over again, it's the synopsis that's not there, or it's not good enough. Remember. Yeah.
I just thought we're all right. It's just the rest of the paper.
Oh, no, well, maybe I made you rewrite the one. Yeah, they were great, though, in the end.
Did you also read a narrative introduction?
Oh, that's good. Thank you for asking. We'll just
I've
do that.
Something like that.
Yeah. But which semester are you? Yeah, so you don't need to do that for your early papers.
I know, I'm just curious about that.
Oh, okay. Okay, here's a narrative introduction. No, that's good. I'll respond to you rather than... I need my glasses. This is Rebecca Martin's paper. Midway through grad school, this is a critical thesis. Midway through grad school, I knew I had a problem when people's comments began to sound alarmingly the same. This story seems blank, impressionistic. I can't tell what the narrator wants or what she feels about other characters. That's two quotations. Once, to my horror, a workshop participant said she was annoyed by my narrator's condescending attitude, an attitude diametrically opposed to my intention. Advisors pitched in as well. One advisor wrote that I seemed to be holding back. Another said that while the details of my African journey fascinated her, a kind note, my emotional journey was missing from the page. Clearly, I needed to admit that despite my exotic settings and riveting plot points, dazzling only me, apparently, the reader would not turn the page unless she felt engaged by emotion. Why are emotions important? As Barty Kirchner writes in Putting Emotion into Your Fiction, emotions are, quote, more compelling than ideas, facts, and reasoning, which are the stuff of nonfiction. In fiction, the character must act from emotion rather than reason, and emotional truth is the reward readers hope to get from a novel, unquote. Kirchner notes in her essay a preliminary list of techniques for emotional representation: establish character sympathy in the openings, show physical symptoms in your characters, write dialogue that sizzles, create atmosphere in the setting, and use symbolism, feeling, words, and diction in one's writing. I started to write because I wanted to better understand and share perspectives gained from my years of teaching and living overseas, an experience that deeply changed me. But whether my intention is to explore, persuade, or simply inform the reader needs to come away with a lived experience felt through the emotions on the page. In writing this essay, I hope to provide myself with a set of techniques and ground rules that will help the reader experience the emotions of my characters and my own as a nonfiction essayist. See? Isn't that sweet? That just gets straight to the point and sets her up to learn something from what she's doing. And that's, to me, the most valuable thing you can take away from this experience.
First of all, I want to say this is incredibly helpful. I wish I had this lecture 6 months ago, because I don't think it is difficult, but it was really difficult to figure out just what am I supposed to be doing here.
Yeah.
Good advice. But I'm wondering if you can give just a really brief explanation of what the difference is between these type of critical papers or theses and literary criticism.
Okay.
I come from an English background, and this confuses me tremendously.
You are from an English?
No.
You're not.
Not.
Okay. Yeah, you're science. Right, yeah, right.
So,
that was a nice reading last
so
night.
Much.
Huh? She read last night. It's good.
Thank you.
Sad. Yeah. And this little process that I've been going through with you is something I've had to teach people who I've had students with PhDs in English literature. I've had people who are tenured English teachers, and I still have to teach them to stop doing what they're doing and change gears and start reading for the words on the page and for the techniques that the author is deploying. And it's not the same. So a really good sort of difference word is the word symbol. Okay. Symbol, what is symbol? Symbol is something you interpret. It's something the author put in to give meaning to the story, right? I never use that word. The word I use is image pattern, okay? Partly because it's slightly more generic, and I want it to be generic. An image pattern is, to my mind, a thing, a word, or something that repeats through the text and organizes the text simply by repetition. Sometimes, you know, the author will put it in the title to even organize things more. Then you can control and embellish the meaning of that by what I call loading. There's a technique. By putting words next to that word. You know, you say, you put words that you want the reader to think about that word next to that word. That's not, and so then I would want you to quote those words, the loading material. Not tell me what the thing means. Tell me the actual words the authors wanted you to think when you read that word. So, I've got quotes in here, some great quotes from letters that I wrote to students. One student wrote to me and she said, when you mention the word black, I think depression. You know, and that's the wrong move, right? Because the word black is just the word black. So there's a story in the point, right? The main image pattern is a black hole. Now, it's a symbol. It is, okay? If you look at it one way, it's a symbol. That's fine. But that's not going to help you build that structure. So you look at it as a word, black hole, and there's text loaded into it. There's one paragraph of what I call thematic loading where it's called Kurt's Theory of Black Holes, and it tells you the moral philosophical dimension of what that black hole is, kind of despair. Now I'm interpreting because the word despair is not in the text. But
so the literary criticism that we're not to do is when somebody goes in and says, for example, looks at the image pattern and interprets what the
right.
author is meaning.
Right, and says something that's not in the text. So it's quotation, not connotation. Okay?
Thank you.
And so then black hole, so then black becomes a sub-pattern there. And you start to see there's black holes, boom, 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 and then there's black, boom, 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 and then shadows and silhouettes and other things going up. And I still don't want you to interpret, but I want you to see how those words go off.
Just looking at the patterns.
Yeah, just look at the actual literal pattern before you tell me it means anything. That I don't want you to tell me it means anything because I don't care what it means. you know, because the author is telling you what it means. The author is putting in text, and that's what you want to see, is the text the author put in, because that is the way the author controls the meaning, controls the interpretation. I don't want the interpretation. I want you to see how it's controlled by the author. So it's the exact words on the text. Does that make sense? Am I making some sense? Academic criticism is very good and useful and entertaining, and I love it. But it's not. That's not these what these essays are. Yeah.
This is so different than the kind of writing I did when I was using English, and so I'm constantly moving to interpretation. So you're literally saying, you're just identifying what exists on the page in a pattern, but you're not taking any kind of loop at all to talk about purpose,
right.
Effect.
Right. You know, there's some, you know, the effects. You can talk about effects, but the effects are going to be structural. That is, an image pattern that runs through a whole text is going to help unify that text. It's going to help spread whatever meaning there is through the text. Because if you attach a meaning to black hole, and then you split off the black pattern, everywhere the word black is mentioned refers back. Okay? So that's happening, okay, at the level of the structure of the story. But that's got nothing to do with meaning of the story as a whole. Does that make, so fine. Does that make sense?
It does. Well, because then to me it just seems like you're saying, and here is black yet again. And
yes.
Yet again, here it is.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
what you're doing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Black is everywhere in the story. And that's important because what students don't realize is that, yes, it's a symbol is created. There's a nice essay called The Expanding Symbol in a book called Rhythm in the Novel by E.K. Brown, which talks a little bit about this. But the image pattern expanding through the story like that does force the meaning of that symbol everywhere in the story. But don't talk about the symbol. That's not how it's built. And in fact, it may not be built to mean anything to begin with. The author may do this ass backwards, right? The author may put the pattern in and then gradually come to what it might mean. You know, you don't plan it out. I rarely plan things out. I don't know. I hope I've helped you there. Yeah.
Just jumping off what Jen said, it sounds like most of the work goes into conceiving this piece of writing, not actually discovering much through the writing of it.
Say that again.
It's the work is choosing the technique and understanding the technique, not in figuring out why the technique, locating a technique. That's where the chunk of the work.
Well, it's not finding out why the technique there is in terms of the meaning story. Like what you know. So Rebecca does this. Three techniques for emotional presentation. She's solving a problem. Why do you want emotion in a story? Well, it's kind of obvious. But the problem is I can't get emotion in a story. I mean, what are the techniques for putting emotion in a story? Doesn't matter what they mean. I mean, just something I obviously need. Does that make sense?
So it's like you're saying this is how the person puts the emotion in the story,
right.
Not this is the emotion that they're putting in.
Right. That's very good. Yeah. Thank you for that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, it's going to help you if you read examples of these things from the text. Okay. Any more questions? I think there's something I wanted to read here. But, yes?
I was just going to say, maybe to help her out. I was talking to Sasha Feinstein, and I still was having problems getting away from academic criticism. And this concerns poetry, but he said one thing that you talked about, for example, is, okay, let's see what ecstasy is achieved in the poem. How does he do it? So then in the poem you talk about lining, the amount of syllables within a particular moment, and to me that opened my eyes up.
Yeah.
It wasn't that what does the ecstasy mean, it's how does he get there.
Right. Yeah, thank you. That's helpful. You will find in the webpage, the critical papers PDF that I've got there, there's a whole list of things that students do wrong, and it's going to help you. And there's a little section on academic criticism. And if I just read you some of these, I could just read a couple, I think, if I can find my notes. At the top of the page, you notice, this is a letter to a student, okay? At the top of the page, you notice the word dirt in the story. And then you do a paragraph on what you think about dirt is associated, you say, on how you think dirt is associated with darkness. I'm not saying you're completely wrong, but I am saying look at your method here. Instead of sticking to the clear literal repetitions of the word, God, I can't write it myself. I have to reread these. Dark, I meant the word dark. The word dark in the story, okay. Instead of sticking to the clear literal repetitions of the word dark, you bring in the associations from outside the story to support your thesis. The thing we are trying to learn here are the techniques by which a writer repeats references to an image and loads associations into the text of the story by association and juxtaposition. Now, maybe the author thought it is dirt and dark, but it doesn't tell us that, whereas he does tell us over and over that a lot of other things are dark. Black branches, dark brown net, darker gulf, etc. So I don't mean to keep beating a dead horse here. Well, the horse really isn't dead, but I want you to try sticking even closer to just what text is there. Okay. So it's an exercise, okay? The trick is that if you do the exercise properly, it'll start to get into you what's going on here. First of all, you will start to see things in a text that you never saw before when you were simply interpreting it, okay, when you're simply absorbing it. And second of all, you'll start to practice things yourself simply by getting them in the back of your brain and seeing how they're done, okay? So, any other questions? Since we're almost all done anyway. So look at all the stuff on the magazine. There's also a bunch of other writer resources on that page, including grammar and punctuation books, which almost all of you need. Sorry, I didn't really mean that. There's examples of text. There's also some little notes on different sorts of techniques that you can use. I guess that's all. There's lots of stuff there. So go and check it out. Thank you. Just wait. One thing. I did want to read one. This is what happens when you do it right. This is what I just want to list. This is from a letter to a student who did it right. This is us. Let's start with the essays, since these are your newest work, your newest ideas about writing. They're both excellent. Rarely do I have a student who gets it the first time, but you're learning to read the code. Your astonishment at how obvious and literal the structure is while remaining invisible to the reader echoes my own astonishment when I began to figure all this out. And you counted things and gave me all the examples. You're absolutely right when you say in your letter that this is actually another language, the language of literature. It's a way of thinking that is quite different from what we come to think of as communication, imparting or exchanging information. In a story or a novel, you are thinking by pushing your characters through actions, and what you write and what the characters do excite emotions in the reader, who enjoys being excited that way. Hence, what the story is about doesn't matter. It's how the aboutness is manipulated in a literary way that is important. That's the end.